WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News
app.
I'm Chuck Sievertson. The International Criminal Courts issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Putin, accusing him and other Russians of deporting children from eastern Ukraine.
It is forbidden by international law for occupying powers to transfer civilians from the territory they live in to other territories. Children enjoy special protection under the Geneva Convention.
Courts President Peter Hofmanski. The League of United Latin American Citizens wants the Justice Department to investigate the death of an Army private at Fort Hood, Texas. Lieutenant General Sean Bernabe responding.
At this point in the investigation, there are no indications of foul play. CID is not ruling anything out and will investigate the circumstances leading up to Anna's death fully and completely.
The private's family said she'd been the target of sexual harassment. President Biden hosted a St. Patrick's Day reception at the White House for Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar. This is ABC News. Notorious San Quentin State Prison in Northern California is being changed into a Scandinavian-style rehabilitation center to teach inmates how to live productive lives. The announcement from California Governor Gavin Newsom today. Reaction swift.
With the announcement, some victims' families are appalled by the move. Nina Besselman with Crime Victims United says prison isn't supposed to be about having couches and kitchens and roaming free.
He seems to have completely forgotten the victims.
But Jay Jordan with the Alliance for Safety and Justice, who served time, says it's a way to turn around inmates so they're ready to return to society.
This isn't a get-out-of-jail-free card. This is, hey, what do you need to be successful? Let's give you that so you can get out and do what you need to do to take care of yourself and your family.
Immediately, work is being done to turn it from a prison to a rehab center. Alex Stone, ABC News.
The actor Lance Reddick died suddenly Friday morning from natural causes. He played Baltimore cop Cedric Daniels in HBO's acclaimed drama The Wire. He was 60. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Hey, folks, keep her moving to Civic Media every Saturday and Sunday at noon for the Cripescast with me, Charlie Behrens.
We've been out here all day. We've had five or six beers and only one fish.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matinere. Here's what you need to know. Helping smaller communities that depend on private wells and groundwater is the aim of a new measure introduced this week by Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin. The Healthy H2O Act will provide grants for water testing and help in purchasing systems to remove or significantly reduce the levels of PFAS. The so-called forever chemicals are increasingly being found in wells in Wisconsin and across the country. Wisconsin Supreme Court Chief Justice Annette Ziegler will continue at that post for a second two-year term after being re-elected in private by her fellow justices this week. The court did not release a vote breakdown. On the court since 2007, Ziegler is part of the four-justice conservative majority. On April 4th, voters will choose between liberal judge Janet Protasiewicz and conservative former justice Daniel Kelly. I'm Jane Matinere. This is Civic Media News.
Kids, they're just different than us. They have no inhibitions, consider silverware optional, and can find fun anywhere. And when kids get really sick, they're different than us too. Until now, children diagnosed with blood cancer have been treated like many adults. Not anymore. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society proudly introduces the Dare to Dream Project, transforming treatment and care through advocacy, education, and the largest global clinical trial for kids with blood cancer. For the first time, a specific treatment can be matched to a specific type of cancer in a specific child. It'll be the biggest medical advancement for little patients in history. Dare to dream with us. Support the Dare to Dream Project and all the work that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does at LLS.org.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org, brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, How are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The International Criminal Courts issued an arrest warrant for Russian President Putin.
Miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I got to start today off with, I don't often talk a lot about right-wing commentators, but I saw Ben Shapiro had a little, and I'm not sure where this video was, but it's a little clip of him ranting on about school lunch programs. I'm not sure if he was at his kitchen table just, you know, ranting on about those. He said school lunches are not going to solve the problem of child hunger at any serious level. He went on to say it does not take much money to feed a child. And he went on this rant about, you know, how if you have a child who's hungry, you should feed them first. There's a whole bunch of that kind of, as a working class white male, I identify with. My kids, you know, never going to go hungry. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to ensure that they do not go hungry. You know, I think about myself growing up as a kid. There were many, many times when the cupboards were empty. And my mother had to look at me, you know, helpless, going, nothing, can't do anything. Because there were no jobs, there were no resources. We were basically on an island. And I look at this comment, this privileged, I mean, really very privileged comment by Ben Shapiro. And while as a working class white male, I kind of get it. I kind of get the I'm going to make sure that my kids are taken care of, I'm going to be responsible, that working class ethic. I look at him as someone who, you know, tell me you've never missed a meal by without saying a word. Tell me you have a certain amount of privilege that you don't know what it's like to struggle. You know, I've often said, and I tell my kids this, I never want to be in a position that my mother was in, to have to look into my kids' eyes and know that there's no way, that there's nothing I can do to help them. That there's no way I can, there's nothing I can do to feed them. And I've met people over the years who have been in that situation. I was, you know, as I was preparing for this today, I was thinking about a woman from Pittsburgh that I ran into who was, you know, a couple years after her struggle, was then working as a co-founder of a food bank in the Pittsburgh area to help other women like she had been at one point. She was working two minimum wage jobs, trying to get some schooling and some education to get better. No child support, no anything. Made just enough money that she didn't get food stamps or any of that, because we got to have those caps. And she did. She fed her children first. And on a number of occasions, actually passed out from hunger. Went days without eating because didn't have the resources. And I think of how cruel and how outrageous it is for someone who clearly, you know, an extraordinarily wealthy person, to look down on people who are struggling to feed their children and say, you know, well, school lunches can't solve the problem. I think you don't know what the problem is then. The problem is food. The problem is getting food on the people's tables. I look at what Feeding America says, that we've got 34 million people in this country that are food insecure, 9 million of them children. 53 million people in 2021 turned to food banks. 100% of the counties in this country have people who are food insecure. So it affects everyone in every neighborhood all over this country, but not, of course, are very well-to-do. The NEA says that 1 out of 6 kids lack constant food access. And what we know, if you feed the kids, they're probably going to do a lot better in school. They're going to learn better. You get them breakfast, you get them lunch. They're going to be more settled. They're going to be more concentrated. They're going to be able to pay attention. They're going to be able to learn. It's a better environment. And to have someone like Shapiro, very wealthy guy, an influencer in the right-wing community, you know, solidifying this view that, you know, it doesn't take much. His comment, it doesn't take much money, is the part that gets me, because it doesn't. And this is the moment where I go, you're right, Ben. Oh, my goodness. Ben Shapiro said something I agree with. It doesn't take that much money. It doesn't. You may remember last summer. Last summer, Congress passed this Keep Kids Fed Act. It extended a bunch of waivers so that schools could provide free and reduced lunches. What they wanted was for free lunches, because all during the pandemic, breakfast and lunches were all free for everybody, not just the kids who fell into different brackets because their parents' income, but everybody. They just said, you know what? We're going to provide breakfast and lunch for everybody. And I think that's what we should be doing, because, say, you know, we believe in these programs. We think it's important. And here's the thing. If we did that, I think by doing that, they might actually get better. But thank you, Rand Paul. One guy, Rand Paul, one guy in the U.S. Senate held this up and said, no, you've got to have some skin in the game. So now the only people who receive free lunch under this federal program are people who fall under the poverty, under 130% of the poverty line. If you're in that 130 to 180 5% area, you're going to get a reduced. So I think they said the school lunches are like $1.80, $2. That's going to be like 40, 50 cents. And you go, well, what's 40, 50 cents? Well, for people who don't have it, it's a huge thing. And as someone who myself remembers having to go to school and get the reduced lunch or the free lunch from the other line, being separated out, I remember it being something of a big deal. Where I went, I just said, you know what, I'm not going to do it. This is where, again, the Shapiros of the world, and I'm going to say that he wants to come at this from, I'm going to give him all of the credit that I can. I want to believe that he wants the best for kids. I'm struggling to not believe that people are just cruel, self-centered, and hateful. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt here. He's right. It's not a lot of money. 30, 40 cents, 50 cents to ensure that a kid gets to eat. I'm sorry. We're going to bail banks out to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. We give corporate America hundreds of billions. We've given banks trillions of dollars in bailouts over the years, but to help feed a child? It's crazy. My friend Sammy Sheets, he's a state representative out in Iowa. He had a piece of legislation that got bipartisan support to fix this problem, to make sure that there were free lunch programs. There were even some Republicans. I guess he had 20 Republicans who came on board. And the leadership said, no, we can't do a vote. Sorry. Oh, it's such a nice bill you wrote. You know, maybe next time. And you think about this, you go, well, what about those kids from now till next time? What about those families from now till next time? I know. But Rick, you know, the Ben Shapiros of the world and the folks who follow him, they love the children. Not so much. And for me, the school lunch thing has always been a big deal for me. Because, as I said in the past, one of the first things Ronald Reagan came in and did was destroy this program. I remember in the summertime, you used to be able to go to the local public school or some community place and get a hot lunch. Now, this work, a lot of kids I knew, it's the only hot meal they got during the day. Reagan destroyed that. You know, Mr. Ketchup is a vegetable. Destroy that, because, you know, it was going to make those kids lazy. Going to make them dependent. It just made him hungry. Now, fortunately, this is coming back. It's back, I guess, and they're trying. But this idea that Shapiro's throwing out to his flock, people who do have the means. And look, I'm fortunate enough to have the means that my kids have never missed a meal. They don't know what it's like to go to the cupboards and it be empty. Trust me, their mother would never allow it. But too many families in this country don't have that luxury, don't have that ability, aren't that fortunate. And that's where, again, this my Christian nation friends, and this is where I reach out to, you know, I know you're waving the flag a lot and you know, wanting to stand up in the restaurant and do your prayers and do all that stuff. How about following the teachings? And if we can't agree, this is one of those things, if we can't agree on feeding children, I don't know that there's anything that we can agree on. I don't know that there's common ground to say that in school, lunch and breakfast should be included as part of the day so that kids aren't separated aside and we shouldn't mandate that kids who, well, can afford it, get, and can't, don't. It seems like this is a place where we want to encourage all kids to be able to go as far as their talents, not their pocketbook, can take them. Now, I have whole bunches of problems with the school lunch program. The fact that, you know, we have a system that says if you can't afford it, we're gonna literally steal the food back from you. That's insane to me. The fact that we chase parents down and deny kids lunch in certain places if they carry balances. That's insane to me. The fact that we privatize and profitize school lunch programs is even more insane to me. You know, I'm old enough to remember where we had, you know, local lunch ladies who came in and they made the stuff right there. You got what was made there, not prepackaged. I guess Lunchables are making a comeback again. I got questions about that. But here we are in another one of these moments where the people who tell us how much they love the children, how much they care, are the ones leading the policies that are harming our kids. And yes, I'm going to blame Trump again. You know, Trump and his administration rolled back a lot of the nutritional requirements that came out of the Healthy, Hungry, Free Kids Act back in 2010. I know the dreaded Michelle Obama, make them eat apples, make them eat apples. Yeah, but not only did you say have them eat apples and vegetables, they provided them. I know. But Rick, they wouldn't eat them. Put it, if they're hungry, they're going to eat it. Help them. This is the education process. Want to hear your thoughts. One guy, just one guy. I mean, honestly, one guy, Rand Paul, held this whole thing up. One guy. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Want to hear your thoughts. Should we have free school lunch programs? Or is this, hey, if your parents can't afford it, shame on you. Go out and get a part-time job shoveling snow. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've had a bunch of MAGA folks reach out to me telling me to stand with the Lauren Boberts of the world and the other Republicans who are saying, you know, don't bail out the banks. And my response has been, you know, along this line. I can't stand with people who are responsible for the situation that we're in. I just can't. They are the cause of where we are. If you were preaching deregulation all during the Trump era and you were voting to you know, take the regulators off and loosen regulations and allow the kind of shenanigans to happen that happened, you're kind of responsible. And now you complaining that, oh, the regulators didn't do their job or whatever other nonsense comes out of your mouth. Shut up. This is one of those moments where we had regulations in place for a specific reason. And that reason was we didn't want them crashing the economy again. And we're in a moment where we don't know how deep this is. We're at the beginning of this journey. And I think you do have to, I think the president doesn't have a choice, but to say that we're going to insure all of the depositors because we don't want a massive run on the banks. But again, this is another one of those things where you go, I sure would like the people who are responsible to be held accountable. I would sure like the people who are responsible to suffer because of this. Because I'm tired of bailing them out. And I know working people are. I've seen some protests popping up, you know, saying, oh, we shouldn't bail them out. And I'm struggling with it like everybody else. But I look at John Tester, the senator from Montana, and I said this right from the start. They should claw back, and Tester's saying this in a letter to the FDIC folks, that they should use every tool at their disposal to get the bonus money back from all of the people at the Silicon Valley Bank. And I said this from the beginning. Every one of those people who took a bonus, not only should we claw that money back, we should give them the consolation prize of shiny bracelets and then a car ride off to a place, to the Gray Bar Hotel. We can give them a nice long vacation. Because this is one of those things where there's got to be the accountability. And I know President Biden has said we're going to hold people fully accountable. I still want to know what fully accountable is. But Tester in his letter wrote that it's clear that bank management made poor decisions and ignored risk factors that ultimately resulted in Silicon Valley Bank's failure. Regulators and law enforcement must take steps to investigate the action of former bank management to hold them the reasonable parties accountable and ensure similar mistakes are avoided in the future. This is why you have a cop on the beat. This is why you have regulators. Now, what's interesting is we find out now Signature Bank, one of the other banks that failed, surprise, 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 they were being probed. Probed, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Probably not probed enough, but the Justice Department was looking into them because of the crypto stuff. They were looking at money laundering going through these banks, and you start going, you know, this again. One of those things. Now, this is the Signature Bank is where Barney Frank was. I know he was just a board member, but there's part of me that goes, and I said this yesterday on the show, those executives, all the board members, everyone in any decision-making capacity, you should go after them. There should be a consequence there should be repercussions for bad decisions. You, me, everyone else, if we make a bad decision, we pay for it. And this is what just it comes down to basic fairness. And this is where I understand my MAGA friends are justifiably angry, as are, to be honest, across the political spectrum. The working class is angry in this moment because the working class never gets this kind of break. Ever. Well, I mean, you know, Biden did give everyone $1,400, but now that's what blamed on all this massive inflation, because you and the working class clearly are unable to handle $1,400. But we can give, you know, security of tens of billions to our banker friends. But it's this sense of fairness. And this is where I'm hoping the Biden administration is listening and the Justice Department is listening. This idea of some bit of fairness that these folks who are doing this, who have done this, that they get held accountable too. I mean, I go back to 2008, 2009, and into 10 even. The number of families who lost their homes because they lost their jobs, it wasn't their fault. And this is so we can be very crystal clear. If it weren't for the thousands of people who would lose their jobs, if it weren't for these startups who employ people who would go belly up and lay off all these people and the homes that would be lost and the families that would struggle and the kids who would go hungry and that ripple down effect that would happen, if it weren't for that, I would say screw these people. Let them suffer. But here's the thing. They know that we're not going to do that. And this is why I find it interesting that in MAGA world, as long as it's not them, they don't care. Which is why I every time I look at these moments, I think of Pat Toomey, the former senator from Pennsylvania, who said back in 2009 and 10 that he would have preferred that collapse, that crash, that pain to be much deeper. He would have preferred that trough to go much deeper. And for it to have been much more painful. And why? Because he believes that, you know, we would have had a better rebound. Now, what does that much deeper mean? That much deeper means you and me and other working people, we'd have lost more jobs. Millions more people would have lost jobs. More people would have lost their homes. They would have lost their savings. They would have lost a decade of retirement. Their kids would have lost opportunity. It would have been a cascade of terrible. And they're okay with it because it's never going to be them. This is my problem with having millionaires and billionaires as the ones who are leading our public policies. The people who are willing to take the guardrails off of our economy are the ones who know they're never going to be responsible. And then they sell us on, hey, you know, if we can do all of these risky things, it might trickle down to you. Maybe our insatiable appetite for more will be filled. Maybe. And we know that's not true. And we know they're going to take risks that are going to eventually flip around and bite who? You and me. Not them. It's never them. And that's my problem with this. And I had someone say, well, you know, the taxpayers aren't going to foot the bill for this. Yeah, we are. Maybe not all of it, but eventually it's going to hit us because it always does. Because we haven't seen where this is going to go. Because here's the thing. When one goes and another, you then start to see that they were all doing this. That they're all in the same pool. That they all are feeding out of the same trough. And as long as we're the backstop, we're the ones who are going to end up footing the bill. So I'm waiting to see how many more banks are on the failure path. I'm waiting to see how many more of these depositors we're going to have to insure. Because we have to. Again, they've created an environment where there isn't any choice because I'm not willing to let more kids go hungry, more families go homeless. Just not gonna be there. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you willing to see that happen? Should we allow them to fail? Should what should failure look like? You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any of our program, make sure you download the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcasts, you'll find ours. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1940. That was the day that Grapes of Wrath opened in movie theaters. Adapted from John Steinbeck's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, John Ford directed the film, which starred Henry Ford as Tom Joad. Pleased with the adaptation, Steinbeck stated, quote, "It pulled no punches and was in fact harsher than the book. It is considered one of the greatest films of all time." Like the book, the film focused on the plight of poor white tenant farmers fleeing Oklahoma for a better life in California. The Joads were devastated by Dust Bowl conditions, bank foreclosures, and mechanization during the Great Depression. They joined thousands of other families heading west on Route 66 to advertised farm jobs that never materialized. The family gets stuck in New Deal resettlement administration camps and ends up on both sides of agricultural worker struggles. They narrowly escape starvation and state police. At the time of its release, The Grapes of Wrath was critically acclaimed for its depiction of the poor. But the Associated Farmers of California condemned it as communist propaganda. Steinbeck visited resettlement camps as part of his research. Union organizing and police violence unfolded during the Salinas lettuce strike, which began as he wrote. Woody Guthrie's classic Ballad of Tom Jones soon followed the movie's release. Recent critics contend that Agricultural Adjustment Administration policies were more to blame than banks. Others assert it presents a sympathetic portrait of white tenant farmers at the expense of black sharecroppers. Historian Eric Loomis adds that Steinbeck and Ford both disappear the plight of non-white exploited labor already in California. Nonetheless, the film and movie both provide a deep look into the misery created by the Great Depression. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Not so long ago, book burnings were considered a festive group activity by assorted right-wing zealots. Today, though, burning seems so old-fashioned and, well, crude. Yet the concept is burning hotter than ever among a gaggle of testosterone-driven Republican leaders, eager to show voters that they will go to extremes to incinerate progressive ideas and people's personal liberties. Rather than lighting bonfires, though, the new fad for GOP politicians is simply to use government power to ban the offending books, thus saving the expense of matches and lighter fluid. It might not surprise you to learn that our Lone Star State's extremist political operatives are leading today's book-banning frenzy. One Jonathan Mitchell, for example, is going from town to town pushing Texas Republican office holders to pass local ordinances he labels Safe Library Patron Protection. Yes, patrons, censoring what you can read is necessary to protect you. The GOP ban prohibits libraries from having books, videos, etc. that contain, quote, immoral content, which he defines as depictions of nudity, sexual behavior, mentions of masturbation, LGBTQ life, etc. It's also autocratically homophobic, making it illegal for librarians to display LGBTQ flags. He even concocts a right of right-wing vigilantes to enforce the ordinances, authorizing bounty hunters to roam the countryside suing local libraries and individual librarians. To spur this political malice, Mitchell's scheme provides a $10,000 reward for every violation of vigilante fines or fabricates. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, repression doesn't recognize state borders, so the pernicious idea of paid library marauders is spreading across the country. To help defend your freedom, go to American Library Association, ALA.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm looking at Michigan, and you know, look, over the in the fall, we were in Michigan for our Working Class Heroes radio tour, and you could sense that there was something happening there. You know, the more people we talked to, you know, from the Uber driver to the waitress at the diner to the, you know, the people working in the hotels to the people at the events we held, you could sense that there was something going on, that people were tired of what they were being shoveled and they were ready for some change. And you saw a massive sweep of Democratic candidates taking back the House, the Senate, and continuing to hold on to the governor's mansion and the attorney general. I mean, a complete blue wave. And now it's paying off because they're moving legislation. In fact, just the other day, the Senate moved to repeal their No Rights at Work bill. This a huge thing. Could be the first state in 60 years when Gretchen Whitmer puts her name on this to turn back the rights at work stuff. And here to share some thoughts on how important this is, if nothing more than the messaging coming out of it, I've asked my good friend Andy Levin to come talk with us, former Michigan congressman and distinguished fellow, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Andy, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to talk to you as ever.
So huge, huge news coming out of Michigan. In fact, you know, when the Democrats took power, I was saying, everybody, watch Michigan, Democrats, for how you should run the steamroller when you get the keys.
Well, my brother, you know, it wasn't a sure thing, and it still, you know, there's still a long way to go, but I have been so impressed by how Gretchen Whitmer and the new leadership of the legislature, Winnie Brinks in the Senate, Joe Tate in the Speaker of the House, you know, what they've been able to do. They've been steady, and they're just knocking off their bills one after another. And yeah, we got rid of right to freeload, and Whitmer, it's all just for Whitmer to sign it. And we're going to restore prevailing wage. We're going to do a whole lot more to, you know, restore workers' rights in this state. They'll get into health care. You know, I hope they get into staffing. I mean, I hope they get into a lot of things that workers of all kinds need, health and safety stuff. I mean, look, the Republicans have controlled the bulk or all of Michigan state government for my entire adult lifetime, 40 years. And you know what, people say 40 years, but actually it was only for a minute 40 years ago when Democrats got control because a couple of legislators were recalled. It was super easy to recall people then.
Yeah.
The Republicans now made it a lot harder to recall people. So now they're stuck with this Democratic. It's a slim majority in both the state House of Representatives and the state Senate, as you know, Rick, but it's there. And they're kind of soberly going about their business, knocking off one item after another. We're going to have sensible gun reform. We're going to have expansion of civil rights, you know, so it's all coming.
But this is what I've been saying for the longest time. When Virginia did this a couple of years ago, I'm going, you've got to move something. You've got to make it appear that you're making people's lives better. You've got to move policy that is going to give people the opportunity to have better lives and do something. Don't just sit there, do something. And this is what I'm seeing out of your government there. And this is a good thing in my view.
You know, you're so right. I just feel like it was astounding. You know, you're in Congress, right? The Republican Party in Congress, really, there's nothing that they promote that helps a working class person, whether it's taxes, regulatory policy, Lord knows about, you know, workforce rules, you know, overtime, sick pay, everything, vacations. They don't help you in any damn way. And yet the Democrats do such a poor job of getting stuff done and also explaining what they're doing that the average working person isn't at all clear which party is taking care of their business. That is pathetic. And Michigan needs right now, Michigan needs to show the way of how you can pass a bunch of legislation that actually makes people's lives better. You know what, Rick, when the previous Republican governor Snyder got in there, he started taxing people's pensions, and we have repealed that now. So there's nothing more straight up than that.
Yeah, no.
To tax the really rich people and the corporations, or are you going to tax like some working stiff who now that they have their little pension and you're taxing it? Come on. So that's we need to do a bunch of that, and then they need to make very clear who did it and take credit for it and explain it to people. You know how busy people are in their lives. You know how many people work at two or three jobs, or if they've only got one, they're taking care of their parents, they're taking care of their kids, whatever. And so, you know, we need to really share the good news with people in a way that it reaches them.
No, we need to go back and undo the damage of the past. And I've been saying all week that, you know, bipartisanship always seems to bite working people in the behind. So I'm not a huge proponent of bipartisanship. I look at all this deregulation, these bank collapses that are happening, because back in 18 they decided, hey, let's work in a bipartisan fashion and deregulate a portion of this, and now it's biting us in the behind. This is a moment where we need people who are going to stand up and fight for working people, and not, oh, well, we can do half measures.
My brother Elizabeth Warren is telling the truth right now about these banks. I mean, look, just think about this for a second. This bank in Silicon Valley goes under, and hey, there's insurance, right? Up to $250,000, the FDIC. For somebody like you or me, it's like, okay, I never had $250,000 in a bank. Can you imagine? That's cool. They've got that insurance. Okay, these Silicon Valley bigs have millions in there, right? 10, 20 million. And within minutes, the federal government's coming in and saying, we're protecting all of that. Whoa. I mean, can you imagine if they did that in any, like, what about all the student debt hanging out there? You don't see the whole world coming and say, whoa, we're going to wipe out all that debt. You know, we can't even get 10, 20,000 of it relieved. Now they're going to protect millions. So, you know, there's a place for bipartisanship. There's a place for it. But a lot of the bipartisan stuff that Democrats, don't just think about Biden time. Go back to Carter and Clinton. Under Carter, we deregulated trucking, right?
And airlines. Yep.
That was a big mistake for the working people and for passengers, right? So,
you're making my argument, Andy.
You and I sometimes see things a little bit the same way.
You go to the Carter years. You got the telecom bill in '96. You got the food stamp, the work thing, the food stamp thing. You got a lot of the bad Gingrich Clinton stuff that was horrible for working people.
Yep. Bill Clinton and welfare as we know it. Okay. You know, I mean, a lot of, a lot of times common sense gets thrown out the window in a rush to do something bipartisan. And I think the kind of bipartisanship I like is when Democrats get sizable majorities in both houses and actually run things that are good for working people, like creating Social Security.
Yep.
Creating Medicare, creating Medicaid, passing the Fair Labor Standards Act, the National Labor Relations Act. Really, you know, and if some Republicans want to get on board, that's fine. God bless them. And I'll give them credit for it, you know. But in truth, most of what we see as the scaffolding of justice in this country in terms of our federal laws were passed in the 30s and the 60s by overwhelming Democratic majorities in both houses under FDR and LBJ.
Right.
And that's just the truth of it.
That's the truth of it. But here's the thing, and this is where I keep coming back to, we should be fighting to do this again today, because right now, you know this as well as anyone, you've got a governor in Arkansas who just signed a bill to loosen child labor laws. You look at what's going on out in Iowa. They're attempting to just eviscerate child labor laws. There is a movement across this country to get kids back to work, because, Andy, we need cheap labor.
Okay, right. I was a paper boy, the Daily Tribune.
So was I.
I worked at Java Junction as a busboy, right? We worked from when we were kids.
I didn't work on the kill floor of the meat processing plant, though.
I mean, there's a place for it. You know, it was appropriate for me to be a paper boy and a busboy and so forth, and on the jobs I did. But this thing, just take Arkansas, right? I mean, the idea of saying that parents and schools don't need to know and weigh in when children are working in any of these jobs when they're 14, 15 years old. It's shameful. I mean, what are they, they're streamlining, they're getting rid of red tape. They're making things more efficient. I don't want it to be more efficient for some 14-year-old to be able to end up in a meatpacking plant with nobody knowing about it. That is not a safe thing, or running some, you know, heavy equipment. I mean, that, you know, we're really talk about getting back to the days of the robber barons.
No, exactly. And this is where this is where, you know, I come to you as someone, you know, served in Congress a very long time. You're at the front of the messaging. How come Democrats aren't running this message going, look, we're the party that ended child labor. We're the ones who defend children and child labor. Where you've now got all I hear from Republicans is all about trans kids. That's all they're concerned about. But we'll put them on the kill floor in Iowa and give a liability shield to the corporations as long as they're paired up with the school district. It's crazy, the messaging losses here.
You know, you are so right. Wow. The way you put it is really something, Rick. The idea that it's pro-family to, you know, yell at who goes in what bathroom or something and then let kids go, you know, run huge saws and meat cutting machines and all this kind of stuff. I mean, exposés, I'll tell you a little bit of why I think, a couple reasons why I think Democrats sometimes aren't better about this. Number one, they are sometimes running the store when it happens. I mean, look, Governor Whitmer's great, right? She's a Democratic governor. This recent New York Times expose, first sentence was Grand Rapids, Michigan, right? I'm not saying Whitmer's personally responsible, but she, you know, people need to not get defensive and say, this is horrible. I, you know, we're not accepting this and we're stepping up. And the second reason is just how much damn money there is in politics. That every, you got to come follow the money in every case, right? When you're, and people who take corporate money, and they may take money from any one of these kind of big industries, whether it's textiles, meat packing, manufacturing, whatever it is, there may be a big employer in their district. I mean, heck, you had a Hyundai big supplier having a lot of child labor, right?
Yeah.
And so, but you, that is such a good point. They're yelling about trans kids while they're letting kids get maimed at work, you know, when they're 14, 15 years old. That is nuts.
Yeah, I mean, I was just reading an article yesterday, the Wall Street Journal, that the apparel companies are worried that they don't know what they're going to do without China because they don't know what they're going to do about cheap labor. And I'm like, the perfect thing, they're laying the groundwork right now. We're just going to bring it back here so we can have kids work in the sweatshops. But they'll be okay with that. Just as long as they're not wearing the dresses, they'll be fine.
Oh, my God. You know, this idea of make it in America and bring the jobs back, I'm so, you know, I've been for it. And to be honest, I look at some of the people trying to jump to the front of the cheering line who voted for every damn trade agreement that sent all these jobs away in the first place.
Yep.
And now they're saying, make it in America. I'm like, oh, okay, well, as long as you're saying that now, I guess. But, you know, you are so right that it doesn't mean that much to make it in America if we're going to bring back child labor. I mean, that is just beyond the pale. So the Democrats should be beating this drum very loudly. And you're right on about that.
And this is where we need to get into places like Michigan. We need to go back into places like Iowa, get into Wisconsin, into Ohio, into Pennsylvania, into these former manufacturing states and say, look, we're going to do what Trump said he was going to do. But we're actually going to do it instead of just talk about it. And this is what I give Biden credit for. You know, Biden doesn't speak very well. You got to admit that. But he's walking the walk. So I don't care if he can talk the talk. As long as we're bringing jobs back, we're reshoring manufacturing, we're shoring up the future, I think he's doing a fabulous job.
Well, I agree with you. You know, I think the pandemic really smacked people in the face. I mean, it's a national security problem if you don't make any dang steel in your country and you need to make, you know, weapons, even though I think we could cut our defense budget, but obviously we need to make, you know, tanks and jets and munitions and so forth. But it's also, we realized, a national security issue. If you have a huge pandemic and you don't have anything that you don't make any of it here, you don't make the tubes, the syringes, the swabs, the masks, nothing. I mean, and you know, we have just got to start manufacturing things on a large scale again. You know, all the excuses that they made from the Reagan era until yesterday. Oh, it's the UAW's fault. You know, oh, it's you know, we priced ourselves out of the market, you know, too many unions. Well, listen, Germany is way more unionized than America, and the labor costs are higher, and they don't have 5 or 10% more of their GDP for manufacturing. They have twice as much of their GDP, twice as much for manufacturing as we do. So don't give me all these excuses. We can make things here again with good union labor where people make a middle-class living and can retire with dignity. And otherwise, there's, you know, what's the point in doing it if we're just going to have sweatshops?
I mean, yeah, I'm right there with you. Last thing I wanted to ask you about, I just saw that crude oil prices are down 8%, down to $65 a barrel. It's the lowest it's been since 2021. And I'm going, at $65 a barrel, shouldn't prices be coming down? How come prices aren't coming down?
Wow. I try to get gas at Costco because it's the when I go there, because it's the cheapest. And even there, it's like 330 something there and 360 something at the regular. I mean, it's outrageous. The reasons are, I think, simple. One is just greed.
Yep.
I mean, you just have to line up the profits that these oil companies are making with the prices. And they are loving this, and they hide behind the magic hand, the invisible hand, nonsense. You know, they have been just making money hand over fist. And you know who's most vulnerable to this. I mean, a wealthy person may have a car that uses a lot of gas or something, and may whatever. But the average working person spends a way higher percentage to fill their than the rich person, just to fill their pickup truck or little sedan to get to work and back every day. They don't have a choice. They've got to do it to get to work. And so, you know, I think we really have to both go after this, these obscene profits, and move more aggressively to diversify the, the energy system.
And not just on that front, Andy. I mean, on everything. The inflation has just gotten out of hand. And I argue most of it has to do with the fact that we've got greedy CEOs and opportunist corporations are going, hey, we can fleece American consumers because, hey, they've got to eat eggs and pie crust and all the other stuff that we've tripled and quadrupled the price of to line our pockets. And if you look at their profits margins and their profit and their calls, they're all admitting it.
Exactly. When they talk to their investors, they say this is the greatest time. And then they, you know, they try to run a different line when they talked, you know, to Congress or something. But if one of these huge supermarket chains or meat suppliers or whatever, all these companies are making huge profits. If they said, look, we decided to make 10% less profit because of all this trouble, and then you all have to pay a little more. Okay, you know, that seems fair. They got to make some profit, right? But the idea that they're making more profit and much more profit during, that's just gross. I mean, that is inappropriate. Yep. It's unacceptable. I think it's un-American.
Where's this generation's Harry Truman? When do we start breaking these people up? Where's Teddy Roosevelt when we need him?
Yeah.
That's right, my on. Thought. Andy, I appreciate the time, though. Always great talk with you. I hope you'll come back. I know you're doing a lot of great work at the Center for American Progress there as one of the distinguished senior fellows. I hope you come back and share some thoughts on what you're working on there. And I know you got a bunch of other things going on. So by all means, please come back and share with us.
Will do. Thanks, Rick. Thanks so much. Take care.
Good stuff. Our good friend, former Michigan Representative Andy Levin. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1999. That was the day that Bruce Springsteen was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. 2 years later, an article in Rolling Stone magazine read, "For nearly four decades, Bruce Springsteen has been a working class hero." a plain-spoken visionary, and a sincere romantic whose insights into everyday life, especially in America's small-town heartland, have earned comparison to John Steinbeck and Woody Guthrie. At the core of Springsteen's music are the struggles of working people. Often, his music connects to past lyricists and novelists and the history of the working class. His 1995 album, The Ghost of Tom Joad, opens with a song about the iconic hero from Steinbeck's classic, The Grapes of Wrath. In 2006, Springsteen released an album of covers of the folk music legend Pete Seeger. In perhaps his most well-known song, Born in the USA, Springsteen tells the story of a Vietnam vet struggling to find work. In another song, he hauntingly weaves a tale of the radical conflict that emerged when Vietnamese immigrant fishermen moved into Galveston Bay, Texas. Springsteen's songs chart the history of American work, from labor on the Erie Canal to the mighty steel forges of Youngstown, Ohio. His 2012 album, Wrecking Ball, captured the devastation caused by the Great Recession of 2008. They destroyed our family's factories and they took our homes. They left our bodies on the plains. The vultures picked our bones. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So this is going to be fun. Evidently, there's going to be a like a mega campus in D.C. What are they calling this? It's a it's Patriots Row. That's what it's going to be. Evidently, this Conservative Partnership Institute, co-founded by former South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint. I guess Mark Meadows is part of it. You know, some of the old past need jobs. So they prop up these think tanks or these institutes, and then they throw a bunch of money at them, and they come up with bad ideas and take advantage of their contacts. But they've evidently buying up a bunch of properties near the Capitol. And this Washington Post article is pointing out that they've bought, I guess, four more properties that they have butted up against, three more. They're taking over like a whole block, like $41 million shopping spree, they've said, to buy up these properties, which isn't a big deal. I mean, in D.C., money goes flying around all the time. But it is interesting that, you know, people who call it the swamp, who hate D.C., are buying it up. But there's evidently going to be, one of the places for people like Marjorie Three Names and them to have their, I don't know, whatever they do, their runaways or, you know, their insurrection headquarters or whatever. Some interesting news. George Santos, the representative from New York, you know, the guy who has the very creative, I'm going to say very creative resume. Some would say he's lied out of every orifice. In fact, as my grandfather would say, he would lie when the truth would be better. He has announced that he's going to run. He's filed a statement of candidacy for 2024. That'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Also, here in my state of Pennsylvania, and this will be fun. The state senator who ran for governor and got the worst thrashing in the history of gubernatorial politics in this state, Doug Mastriano, is evidently. There's a push to make him run against Bob Casey for Senate next year. They're claiming he's the only one who stands a chance to defeat Bob Casey in 2024. It's one of these things where I'm going, I don't know. I know his faithful because there are still Doug Mastriano for governor signs in people's yards around my neighborhood, which I find really kind of funny. You want to talk about poor losers? Because lost really. It's like if you were rooting for a football team that lost like 99-0, and then complained about a ref's call in the fourth quarter and believe that that cost you the game. This is kind of that. But they believe, you know, he's going to be the guy. And I'm hoping he is, because it would be good to hold on to another Senate seat in 2024. And it would be good to see another thrashing, because I got to tell you, there was something healing about seeing him getting beat so badly in this state, to kind of let me know that maybe Pennsylvania isn't as off its rocker as I thought it might be. So good on you, my friends in PA. And you're might have another chance in 2024 to send Doug Mastriano back to.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic ABC Media News app.